there's different barriers today when we're still at like only 3% of cars or less are electric than there's going to be when even when we just get to 10%, right? There's just going to be different barriers that are going to have to be gradually changed.
Welcome back to another episode of the Future Car Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Cook, a writer here at Siemens focused on automotive topics. Today, we're going to turn our attention to China. Obviously, a big topic when it comes to everything from policy to innovation, with electric vehicles and otherwise. I have two people for this episode who can really dive deep into the Chinese marketplace, its history, and what the future looks like, especially in regards to EVs. One is Puneet Sinha, who's a PhD here at Siemens working on vehicle autonomy and electrification. Also a past guest of the program talking EVs and batteries. Go back and look for that one in the feed if you're interested. And we have John Paul Helveston, an assistant professor in engineering management and systems engineering at George Washington University. I came across John first in a piece he wrote for Axios on a big policy change in China that's been much in the news. Foreign car makers no longer have to create joint ventures with Chinese firms to make and sell vehicles there. The rule starts with EVs and will be extended to all vehicles by 2020. We'll put a link to that in our show description. Of course, after I read the Axios piece, I Googled John and learned something else about him. It's mobility related, but in a different way than we usually talk about. So real quick, John, before we start, if you Google John Paul Helveston, high up in the search results are videos of you swing dancing. So we got to get that out of the way before we talk about
it. It always comes up.
China EVs. What is the tie between your electric vehicles and swing dancing, or is swing dancing just something you do for fun and you're really good at?
So surprisingly, there actually is a link there. Swing dancing was always just a hobby I started in college. It was like a passion I have, just what I do on my free time. But some of my early positions doing any work in vehicles and electric cars, in particular in China, came through connections I had through the dance network. My first internship in China, working for a transportation nonprofit, I'm pretty sure I got the job because the boss's wife was a dancer and said, like, we really should get this guy over here. So there's, you know, it's a helpful network on top of being a very fun activity.
What is the swing dancing scene like in China?
Oh, it's great now. It's taken a time, you know, to get there, but it's really growing now. It was pretty small when I first went there, late 2000s. But now there's a lot of local Chinese citizens running the scenes. The Beijing scene is probably the biggest one in just terms of numbers. They have regular dances every week. They probably have 200 or 300 people like every time. So it's a nice scene.
Okay, now let's get started. If you're a research buff, you definitely should check out an academic paper John wrote called, you ready for this? Institutional Complementarities, the Origins of Experimentation in China's Plug-in Electric Vehicle Industry. Don't let the title scare you. It's great stuff with tons of good source material, including interviews with more than 50 people from industry and government, lots of data on vehicle sales in China, and 4 case studies of independent domestic EV firms in China. We'll link to the paper in our show description as well.
The big change that really was announced last year was that China is going to do away with this joint venture ruling. So the joint venture system has been in place since the 80s. It's a pretty simple rule. It was just restricted foreign companies from directly entering China. If a foreign company wanted to make and sell cars in China, they had to create this separate company, a joint venture, that is partly owned by them and partly owned by a Chinese partner. And the motivation for that was so that these Chinese firms will be able to learn from the foreign companies. So it was this broader strategy that was implemented across a lot of different industries, not just auto, so that you'll generate these domestic Chinese companies who are eventually going to compete with these big global players. So the idea was it's going to accelerate their catch up. And there's been a lot of work on this, and it's sort of suggested that it's kind of backfired. It didn't really work or play out as anticipated. And instead, we're getting a lot of foreign companies basically controlling the technology and everything that's going into these companies. And the Chinese sides really have a lot of limited learning. They haven't been able to really take off and do things on their own. So now the government is saying, okay, we're going to relax this rule. We're going to do away with it. And if you're a foreign company, you can just come here and set up shop. You can control everything on your own. And so that it's had a long history going back to the 80s, but it's impacting the electric vehicle industry in a particular way. And this is kind of what my study that came out, I guess technically was published this year, really gets into. But the general trend was that foreign companies, because they were so far ahead of these Chinese partners in traditional gasoline vehicles, they were able to sort of bring over slightly outdated technology, but still be competitive. So there wasn't really any local players that were sort of challenging them. And so it's created this setup where there's no real incentive to bring your cutting edge technology. You know, you didn't have to bring it to compete. And if you did bring it, your Chinese partner could take that IP. So just sit back, use some of your existing technology, share that willingly, and make a lot of money. In electric cars, it's kind of the opposite situation. Now, this is a technology where everyone is sort of on a level playing field. So the foreign companies don't really want to bring this to China yet because, you know, they're just spent $1 billion investing it in their home countries. They're not as willing to bring that and share it with their Chinese partners. And because of that, the Chinese partner isn't learning anything. You know, they're not getting that know-how because it's not being brought. So you've got this division, you've got this setup in the market where there wasn't any major players going after electric cars. The side story here is that while all of this is going on, you actually have these other Chinese companies, these independent companies that did not develop with joint ventures. So these are kind of mostly private startups that kind of did everything on their own. They never really had big joint venture partnerships. They just gradually got better at making cars over time. And so in the gas car market, they're not really strong players, but in electric cars, they're dominating. So it's something like 90% of the EV sales were by these independent companies, not these joint ventures. So this joint venture has sort of driven a fork down the market where the gas car market is dominated by foreigners sort of in disguise through their joint ventures. And the EV industry is really dominated by independent Chinese companies doing their own thing. So it's an interesting market. It's pretty divided between the technologies.
When we talked, Puneet was recently back from Shanghai, where he had meetings with customers and Siemens staff. I wanted his take on what he saw firsthand while he was there, what his impressions were.
Yeah, so, you know, China is absolutely a center of gravity in terms of the business potential for EVs. Talking to the Siemens team there and also some of the companies, it is clear that the overall Chinese market is very bullish on electric vehicles. You know, some of the reports and the, even the Chinese analysis have shown somewhere between 20 to 50% of market share for EVs by 2025. So in 2025 is not that far away, 5-6 years. And you're talking about 50%, up to 50% of total market auto share in China. That's huge. Yeah? But at the same time, it's not very preposterous. So if you see even just this year, looking when typically the Chinese economy is not essentially in that full flow that it has been in past, looking at all the sales number for China, especially for EV, it is easy to say it will cross over 2 million EVs this year, which is almost like 80 to 90% increase just in EVs from last year. So there's in itself a tremendous growth happening on EV area. And one thing, I asked this question around why people are so much tuned to buy an electric vehicle in China. And interestingly, two key observations came out, which was a lot more common. One was the fact that a lot of people in China are living in cities. So essentially, their demand for electric drive range is not that much as, you know, people that are being asked for in US. Yeah? So in US, most of the companies are trying to get to, you know, 300 mile range or 500 kilometers. That's not what a lot of Chinese customers are looking for. They are okay with the shorter range electric vehicles. And of course, that brings the overall cost point down. And there are a lot more options. in that, and if you can live with shorter electric drive range in a vehicle. But interestingly, the other point that was quite eye-opening for me was the overall consumer behavior. A lot of the Chinese buyer, especially in the growing middle class, they are very tuned with technology. So they look at EVs as a new, highly technologically advanced vehicle, and there are a lot of technology-related options in those EVs in general compared to the same price IC engine vehicles.
John talks about what he calls a different trajectory of innovation for the domestic EV firms in China compared to joint venture firms. As he said, the foreign joint venture companies haven't wanted to rock the boat too much in China's marketplace. They're profitable and would like to stay that way. So at least historically, there really is no need for traditional gas-powered vehicle manufacturers to step outside of their comfort zone, try new things, bring their best work to this particular marketplace. As for electric vehicles, well, that's a different story.
Electric vehicles are a very different, and there's a whole different technology platform. The core platform of the internal combustion engine is what the ecosystem is centered around. So you have gasoline refueling systems, roads, tax policy, all these things built around one platform, you know, burning gas in an engine. The electric vehicle platform is entirely different. It requires different infrastructure, different supply chains, and different policy. When I look at these independent Chinese firms pursuing this new platform, they're going about it in all sorts of different ways. They're not just trying to make a better battery or you know, just do a sort of straightforward, let's attack the technology. They're also experimenting with new business models, new components to solve particular technology issues. And they're also going after just entirely different market segments that right now are not serviced by the gas car platform. So that's kind of what I meant by these different trajectories, that one side is looking at a broader ecosystem and going after all these different pieces of that ecosystem, whereas the other one is sort of remaining in the current incumbent system and really just sort of incrementally improving in that area.
Jeff, I think John brought up some really nice points. And if I can just follow up on that, John is right that for EVs, even the manufacturing is actually a lot more simpler. You know, if you think of electric vehicle, you know, give and take, you have 20 to 30 moving parts. Compared that to an IC engine vehicle, you have hundreds of parts. So the overall supply chain interaction for EV is a lot more simpler than for IC engine vehicle. And then, of course, if you are a new company who doesn't necessarily have a legacy attachment to a certain vehicle architecture, you can start with a clean sheet of paper and do a lot of interesting things with electric platform, electric vehicle platform. Yeah, a skateboard, a part in architecture where you're putting the battery, motor, inverter. So it gives a lot more room for innovation and starting and even the new entrants to auto market who haven't built vehicles before, they can very easily compete with the established players. Because as John mentioned, completely agreeing to him, the whole playbook is very different for EVs. And then, you know, if you think from the infrastructure side, it's not just about getting an EV out there, also just to satisfy customer need, the range anxiety specifically. The infrastructure has to play a big part. And that's where, if you just compare the numbers, in US, you have give and take around 60, 65,000 charging stations. Think of China, which has pretty much the same land area as US, perhaps 3 to 4 times more population, but it still has around 300,000 charging stations and growing. So the overall infrastructure, charging infrastructure, has reached a level of critical mass that, you know, even if companies are bringing in their vehicles, which have, you know, let's say 100 mile range, 150 mile range, marrying the idea that the Chinese customer is not necessarily looking for 300 mile range to be comfortable with an electric vehicle, and add that to the fact that you have a lot, you know, easier availability of charging infrastructure, is making the EV introduction in market a lot more easier from business perspective in China.
I'll add a bit more even on that. So Penny was right that he was saying about that Chinese customers have different preferences. I mean, I've also done some work studying consumer preferences in China. I did an actual direct comparison between US and Chinese consumers using a survey. And this was actually back in 2012. So at the time, EVs were a bit more hypothetical, but the results from that study showed that Chinese consumers were more willing to adopt full electric vehicles at lower ranges than American consumers on average. And you know, there's a lot of reasons for that, not just the fact that you're mostly driving a car in a city. And so you don't really need 300 mile ranges when you have these amazing high speed rail networks to go across the country in. So you're mostly just driving your EV in a city where you live. You don't have to do this interstate travel like we use cars for here. But also most car buyers are new buyers. About 2/3 of Chinese customers are buying their first car, and many of them have never even driven much. Many of them are getting their license and then buying their car. So you know, just the expectation of what is it to be in a, quote, real car, you know, or how should a car feel and handle? There's a lot of opportunity for these new car buyers who have sort of a blank slate impression of what a car should be to buy an EV and get a feeling like this is what a car should be, you know, from the get-go. Because there is a lot of brand loyalty, cultural loyalty here around internal combustion engines, which is very much a big part of the culture of cars here in the U.S. So you don't really have that there. You have an opportunity to sort of jump forward to this new platform without having to go through this gradual transition phase.
So the rule change just has to do with EVs. And all these companies, including here at Siemens, we talk about, you know, all these trends are pretty interrelated. The big three everybody talks about are automated vehicles, electrification and connectivity or mobility services. And there's lots of overlap between all three. So in China in particular, so you're saying the rules are off, this could, or the rules changed and this may spur the big guys to come to China and do sort of leading edge work on EVs, but not when it comes to automated vehicles, or at least not yet. So how would you see it? First of all, did I get that right? And then how would you see that playing out given that the rule is still in place for automated vehicles?
One of the big things that might change with this rule change is you might see foreign companies now being more willing to go and invest in China more directly, knowing that, or I should say, invest in their cutting edge technologies in China. Now that they have the ability to control their intellectual property, they don't have to share it with a Chinese partner. You have a lot more incentive to go there just for the fact that it's the biggest market in the world alone. So if you're not really playing in that market, you're sort of not really a major player. Just an example of that is look at Tesla's activity. Tesla has pretty much not entered China up until this rule change. They've only imported vehicles and have never agreed to build a factory in China because they would have to have a Chinese partner. As soon as this rule change came up, Tesla started breaking ground on their second gigafactory around Shanghai. So it was an immediate investment and an enormous investment. And you're seeing that type of activity now. And again, this is really applying to the leading edge of automotive. All the global players have been in China for decades with traditional automotive technologies, but this leading edge stuff is where I'm expecting more investment. And just as a clarification, the joint venture ruling is actually going to phase out for everyone soon. I believe next year it's going to be completely removed. It's just that last year they removed it for electric cars immediately. So, you know, for now, only electric cars, you can do that on your own. But by next year, everyone, all cars, you can be on your own. So that's the trend I'm seeing in electric cars. You know, so I wouldn't be surprised to see other companies investing in other major automotive technologies like AVs, vehicle automation, because of the same exact reasons. You know, if you're even a startup company and, you know, not necessarily like GM or one of these big players, but if you're just a startup, but you were also making your car to make an AV, well, to do that in China, you would have had to have a Chinese partner. So there's this huge, you know, a bunch of regulatory machinery that gets engaged. If you take all that away, now all of a sudden, you know, becoming a startup in China, even as a foreign invested startup, is a lot easier. And there's so much talent already there. There's just an enormous amount of talent in terms of just programming ability of Chinese engineers. That there's a lot of motivation to go do some of your development work in China. So I think this rule change my expectation is that it's going to generate more incentives to do more innovation in China, even as a foreign company, and across a bunch of different areas in automotive, not just electric cars.
Electric cars are ascendant all over the place, and China is quite famously the world's largest EV market. In China, as John sees it, there may be something of an organizational skill gap between the domestic Chinese companies and the joint venture companies, again, a byproduct of the regulations put on foreign car makers. There are some small startups and independent companies that really are at the forefront of the EV market in China, at least when it comes to their R&D and their technology. But taking these stories to scale, solving the issue of mass manufacturing, well, that's still a major challenge.
There's a phrase I often hear. I didn't come up with this idea. I've heard others say it, but it's easier to make a Ferrari than a Ford, because a Ferrari is, you know, this incredibly complex, high power vehicle, but it's also highly specialized. And so you only have to make a few thousand a year and you can be commercially successful. And you can also charge kind of whatever price you want, because your customers are just ultra millionaires. Fords are very hard to make and be profitable. You have to make millions every year, and they have to be exactly the same. And they have to have an extremely small threshold of error. Because if there's a single thing, you know, just think about the Takata airbag inflator recalls. There's millions of cars have to be recalled and repaired. That's so costly. So the precision has to be very high. You have to repeat this manufacturing process over and over consistently. And it's really an operations management expertise is what some of the best OEMs are. You know, GMs and Fords and Toyotas, they're just incredibly good at organizing production. So if you told Toyota to go make cell phones, I bet you they could probably, you know, be competitive with Foxconn or one of these other major cell phone makers, because they know how to make things well. So that's certainly the area that we're seeing the difference between these long-standing major automakers like the GMs and Fords. If they want to make an electric car, they will probably have less of a challenge getting those things to market. Whereas a company like Tesla is the exact opposite. You know, brilliant engineering, great design, but not necessarily designed for manufacturing. And so the mass production scale-up has been a nightmare. And that's also a major dividing point within the Chinese market. You know, the two types of companies I've been talking about, these joint venture companies, well, the Chinese side of that doesn't really know how to design a car from the ground up. You know, they've never had to do it. So they've just relied on their foreign partners. But these independent companies like BYD and Geely and Chery, they've been making cars on their own for 15, 20 years. So for them to design an electric car from the ground up, they have a lot of that architectural know-how. And they're being more successful right now in designing a car that is actually competitive in the market.
So EVs are booming in China, but there's more to the story than just a new type of powertrain. Here on the Future Car Podcast, we've been kicking around the idea that the changes in transportation really comprise a chip-to-city story. This transformation impacts everything from the design of individual bits of silicon, goes up through how vehicles are manufactured, and continues in the deployment and use of these vehicles in cities. And all of these activities are interrelated. I was curious and had to ask these guys, what are some of the bigger picture stumbling blocks in China when it comes to the adoption of EVs?
There's different barriers today when we're still at like only 3% of cars or less are electric than there's going to be when even when we just get to 10%. Right, there's just going to be different barriers that are going to have to be gradually changed. Right now, and certainly one that's going to get even worse for China, is purely just parking. It just fundamentally comes down to this fact that the big cities in China have populations far beyond most big cities in the US, like 20 million people. And most people live in this built environment of high-rise apartment complexes. Many of them do have parking garages underneath, but this, you know, limited amounts of space. So there's just a fundamental problem with where am I going to park my car and where am I going to charge it? So, you know, one future is you have fast chargers everywhere. So these things just sort of become effectively the same as how we fuel gas cars. You pull up, you plug in 5 minutes, you're ready to go, and you keep going. That has enormous challenges for the infrastructural side of the power grid. That's not really a solution that's going to come overnight. if that does happen, there's going to have to be major structural changes to the power system. And the alternative is, you know, you have to have major structural changes to how your cities are built. Because you have all these, the way housing and everything has been developed, those are long-term architectural plans that sort of set up the way a city is operated. So that's just going to be a long problem. And the more practical solution is to just get rid of car ownership in general, that you're going to have fleets of cars, you know, like Didi or Uber, that people just don't own cars and they pretty much just hail a car or rent a car for a short term. In which case you're no longer having to park it. You know, you have a fleet operator who brings these things out to the outside of a city where there's more space and they can park and charge overnight. So there's the long-term vision is going to be that type of a vision for these mega cities, because there truly isn't an alternative right now. There's just fundamental limits to how many people are going to be able to adopt an EV in the current business model of car ownership. And that's really driven by parking constraints, things like that. But there's other structural problems that might make this transition a lot slower than I think a lot of people think. So for all the government is doing in China and other parts of the world to encourage adoption, there's lots of other very long-standing institutional factors that sort of want to keep the status quo. So one thing I didn't really emphasize, which was that these big joint ventures, which are by far the major players in the current auto industry in China, most of those Chinese partners are state-owned companies. These are very large companies who are very profitable, and much of that money is going to local level city party members. So there's a lot of political forces here to keep that system profitable and keep that sort of ecosystem profitable. So yes, we want electric cars, but we don't want too many too fast. We want, as long as the current people who are in power kind of can remain in power, that's kind of what those players want. So again, I don't think it's going to necessarily happen overnight. I think it's going to be pretty gradual. And these things will change over time, but there's more barriers here than just technology. The easy answer is like, oh, it's batteries. You know, batteries just aren't good enough and they're too expensive. That problem is solving itself. People are innovating and we're getting there. Some of these other issues are ones that I kind of think about. I think they're a bit more structural. Even if you have a good battery, it's still kind of these problems exist.
In the same research paper that John wrote, which we talked about earlier, he included case studies of four domestic Chinese EV companies. It's cool to have both some of the big picture and the tiny details of the EV story in China. I'd never heard of these companies prior to reading his paper, but they're doing some pretty innovative work in the EV realm, as he describes it.
When I originally went to China, I was expecting to go, you know, interview the big players. I went to GM, I went to VW, and I was expecting lots of stuff going on with electric cars. And I found like very little. And I was just shocked by that. So I actually kind of discovered these companies by an accident. And when we started looking out there to see, all right, who is making EVs? Who is innovating in this space? We found all these different types of companies that, you know, most people have never heard of. I'll talk about one that I thought was a really interesting case, which was Haike. This company Haike is a startup in the city of Changzhou, not far from Shanghai, about an hour train ride. What they're doing is trying to tackle the problem of energy storage, but not from a battery side. They're trying to tackle it from the mechanical side. So what they're designing is effectively a mechanical battery. Their strategy here is that batteries are a major barrier to adoption because they're expensive. They have, you know, limited amount of energy per kilogram that they can store. And so what can we do to get the battery smaller? You know, how can I extend the range of the car, but with half the size of with a smaller battery pack? What they've got is a big flywheel, essentially. It's just a big metal wheel. And when you are hitting the brakes, you're slowing down, it transfers some of the energy from the wheels to this internal flywheel. And it spins it up to very high speeds, like 20,000 rotations per minute. So you've got this wheel inside the car spinning at this very high speeds, and that has a lot of kinetic energy. And so when you fully stop, that thing is now being wound up. And then when you want to accelerate again, you can reverse the flow of that energy. You can send it from the wheel back to the powertrain, the main wheels. So what that does is it smooths out the energy demand on the battery. one of the bigger issues with batteries in cars is that it's the stopping and starting. Whenever you have to accelerate, you need higher peak power. And when you decelerate, you can sort of recover some of that energy. But there's a lot of up and down charge on the battery pack. So if you can smooth that out with a physical wheel, just big hulking piece of metal, then you need a much simpler battery to go extended ranges. And so they're sort of separating out the cruising speed kind of behavior of a car from the start-stop speed. And they're dividing these two things, these two pieces of a driving profile. And the reason is to, again, reduce the battery requirements. So it's this very sort of convoluted way of getting to a major problem, which is the battery, but doing it using a pretty old technology. Flywheels have been around for a long, long time. These same technology is used in like formula racing. There's a lot of hybrid kinetic energy recovery systems, KERS, that's what they're called. They're just sort of taking that technology and bringing it to the mass market. So it's a really different approach of this issue of extending vehicle range. There's nothing really cutting edge about the technology. There's nothing necessarily new about it, but no one has really commercialized it for a mass market application like just a typical car. So I found that really interesting. This is a company that, by the way, the founders is British. So the patent holder is not Chinese. The main founder is a British guy. They came to China because they found this is the ecosystem where they can start to commercialize this technology more quickly. They have more different types of electric cars available, lots of new companies trying to get into this market, and they had a lot of protection locally, a lot of support from the local government to develop this technology. They had free office space, basically free manufacturing facilities, to do their pilot production in. So just enormous amounts of support that's giving them their opportunity to explore a new technology. So again, I think some of the things that are going on in China are not really, quote, high tech, where in the way that I think others might think of. And some sort of look at that as, well, that's not innovating then. But I've kind of got the opposite opinion on this. It's innovation is about taking a technology and commercializing it and bringing it to market. And I'm seeing companies in China take very different approaches to solve a common problem. And I think that's what we're really going to need, is a lot of different experimentation, a lot of companies trying new ideas, and not just within a component or the car, but even changing your business model, coming up with different ways of getting people in cars and moving around.
It is not all about batteries. Although battery is a big part of the, it's essentially the heart of the electric vehicle. But when you look at the vehicle, you have to look at the vehicle level as well. You cannot just put all your eggs in one component and try to just improve that one component, because how battery interacts with motor or other components, in this case flywheel, or there can be other ways to help the energy efficiency of battery or improve the drive range. All that comes into play, so it's about the body weight, it's about the driving dynamics, it's about how you can make the energy flow from battery to wheel more efficient, whether by power electronics improvement, motor improvement, the interaction between battery and other components, all that matters. So the solution to the problems, I mean, if you look at range anxiety as one of the biggest problem, the answer doesn't less only in battery, yeah. So, and that's John was explaining that with an example of flywheel. And yeah, I mean, you can take flywheel, you can think of other ways of doing things. So all that is important, and that is part of what I call engineering solutions. So, so when these things start happening, that your companies are in the process of commercializing a technology. If you have to showcase a technology, you can come up with the ultra super battery way, which can do a lot of things, but will cost you the whole city to build one. But when you're looking at these kind of solutions, smart solution, engineering solutions, you are at the cusp of large scale commercialization.
As we've talked about throughout this whole discussion, the government plays a major role in writing and adopting policies that encourage innovation. As John alluded to, sometimes policies indirectly encourage innovation with one group of companies while stifling it among another group. What I mean is, from the story John told us, it sounds like China is a leader in domestic EV innovation, but not intentionally. So the last question I wanted to ask, how do you encourage innovation? Do you do it at the city level or the national level? And what are the gaps that exist now?
From the case of China, one thing I do want to emphasize, and I try to do this in the study, is just the significance of local institutions, the power of local, especially city level and municipalities, to allow and encourage experimentation locally. China really, the title of the paper is called Institutional Complementarities, which is a really long way of making the point that there's national level things going on, but there's also local level things going on. And it's the complement of these two things that I think are leading to some of the flourishing of new ideas in China. You have a national level sort of message and direction setting, putting things like subsidies out there, sure, but also just conveying a constant message about we need to go electric, we need to move in this direction, calling for national automakers to really take on this challenge. So I think that's an important role. And also setting up national rules. In the case of China, it was this whole story about joint ventures. That was a national level policy that really had a huge impact on shaping the industry and who became a major player and who didn't. But locally, this is where there's a lot of play in China. The local level institutions, there's tons of, many people will call this protectionism, right? They'll say like the city of Shanghai, protects its own local automaker, and every different little city sort of has its own local automaker that they protect. I think a lot of people view that in a negative lens, but at least in what I was seeing in this early stage of a new industry, a new ecosystem that still hasn't really emerged, I'm making the point that this is encouraging a lot of experimentation. So there's tons of work that suggests you need a lot of different ideas to emerge before you get a major breakthrough. So you need diversity. You need, in China, you might say 1,000 flowers blooming. There's a lot of history around that phrase. So local support for local companies, giving them the opportunity to get off the ground when they may not otherwise be able to in a fully pure competitive market. I think there's some merit to that in the early phases of an industry. So autonomous vehicles, that's another example, especially here in the US, where I am seeing lots of different cities, especially cities individually, not just state, but down to the city level, encouraging experimentation, setting up zones and saying, this is going to be a protected area where you can come experiment. I think there is a lot of value to that because if you don't have that, you really don't have many other alternatives for learning and for experimenting. And part of experimenting is failing and having accidents. And what happened in Arizona, nobody wants to happen. But if you also want to make progress, you have to experiment. So this is the challenge for policymakers, is to set up areas that encourage experimentation, encourage investment in new ideas, but do it in a safe way. And that's the fine line where I don't really know what the answer is going to be. But I think that's the goal that policymakers, I think, should go after, is encourage these things to the extent that we feel as a community, or maybe especially if it's a city making a decision, as a city level community is comfortable making, enabling those sort of environments to emerge. Because if you don't have that experimentation, you're really not going to get off the ground and make breakthroughs. That's something that you're definitely seeing happen in China, and with enormous amounts of encouragement at the city level. I get a sense that there's a lot more willingness to take risks in China, to take sort of unilateral action and set up places to do things, to experiment, encourage investment. And so there's certainly a lot of that going on over there. And I think for here, we need to keep up with that as well. Keep encouraging the experimentation, again, up to the extent that we're willing.
The way I look at it, so the China landscape is very different from US. And so not necessarily something that is working for China means it will work for US. Yeah. Risk taking is important, but at the same time, you need to make sure that there are enough safety measures around it. And that's where I think the way we offer from Siemens side is to deliver you that testing or new idea exploration through digital twin, so that you not necessarily have to go on the road and see, let's say in the case of autonomous vehicle, if an accident happened, you can do a lot of testing virtually to avoid such unfortunate events, especially in the case of new technologies, autonomous vehicles, more and more of that needs to happen. It's happening in US. It needs to happen more and more in China. In terms of policy, I think if I, in my opinion, there is one thing that is very, there are two things which are very necessary for any place, especially for US, is consistency in policy. You know, if there were certain CAFE rules, they were put, do not remove them after 10 years because it takes a lot of companies to, you know, change significant in their roadmap to be ready to meet certain CAFE requirements, for example. And also for the testing and regulatory bodies, they need to put more focused requirements on how to test autonomous vehicle. How is I'm bringing up autonomous vehicle an example because this is a new technology, a step change coming through autonomous vehicles in transport industry. But it's, you know, for electric vehicle, autonomous vehicle, regulatory bodies need to set up more consistent methods of testing and certification. Digitalization has to be a big part of it, especially in autonomous vehicle, where you cannot just go and test on road to cover all the edge cases. Yeah, so all those things are required, whether it's in US or in China. And of course, I'm sure these things will happen more and more in near future. But definitely, the more focus efforts, cities or city level, or at the national level, organizations can put in more focus effort, the faster it will help in bringing these new transportation technologies and evolution to commercialization.
Thanks to both John Helveston and Puneet Sinha for taking the time to have this conversation and filling us in on EVs in China, a big story we'll be hearing lots more about in the years ahead, I'm sure. We have more good episodes in the works for the podcast. We'd like to experiment with more and varied content in the feed. And in this vein, next up will be a session from the Urbanism Next conference here in Portland, which was quite interesting. Our own Ed Bernardin was on a panel on digital and policy infrastructure issues for cities grappling with all the trade-offs that come with new mobility. There's good back and forth among the panelists, and you know Ed isn't shy, so he has lots to say too. Check it out and let me know what you think about that. That's all for now. Thank you for joining us today on the Future Car Podcast. For more, visit Siemens PLM Software online. And make sure to check out Puneet Sinha's blogs on EVs on the Siemens PLM website, too. I'll put a link to a few of those in the show description as well. Siemens PLM Software is a world-leading provider of product lifecycle management and manufacturing operations management software. We help thousands of companies realize innovation by optimizing their processes from planning and development through manufacturing, production, and support.